The theme for this morning is called the dignity of the Eucharistic celebration. So that's one of the sections in the papal document. But it reminded me, you remember a few years ago when Prince William and Kate Middleton got married? Okay. You know how many people watched that wedding? 1 billion people watched. So you're looking at one out of almost eight people, or maybe more than one out of eight people. There were like 7.5 million billion people in the world at the time, roughly. One out of eight people in the world watched that wedding. I was not one of them, by the way. Not too interested. But yes, we could ask ourselves, why do we care? Why is this such a big deal? Okay, two people get married. It's beautiful before the eyes of God and humanity. It's marriage is always beautiful, but nobody cares about watching anybody else's marriage unless you happen to know them. Why was this such a spectacle? Well, the short answer comes down to one word, pageantry. Okay? There is a pageantry about the weddings of the British royals that is really kind of unparalleled. And people love to witness it and to take part in it. And I was kind of last night flipping through pictures and just kind of trying to get a feel for the wedding, which I didn't ever watch before. One of the things you notice, though, is only the finest of the finest would have been acceptable. Could you have imagined showing up all these? I have no idea what, you know, the different dresses and suits and everything, thousands and thousands of dollars for each person there. But could you have imagined being in that crowd at Westminster Abbey with the royal guard and all the people present, and the queen wasn't there, but all of the royalty present and the world leaders that flew in and all these representatives, and you show up like in a tank top and your flip-flops and some Bermudas or something. It, like, first of all, you wouldn't be allowed anywhere close. And if you somehow broke into the crowd, you know, and they caught this on the TV cameras and you're out there dressed practically like you're coming home from the beach, you know, it would be a total scandal. It'd be like a shock. There's a reason for that, because frankly, at any wedding, it would be kind of scandalous if you did that. But particularly that wedding, because they're not any more important than anybody else. But behind all the symbolism is the fact that there's a kind of a subconscious message. This is about more than just William and Kate. They represent England. They represent something bigger than themselves, and therefore the entire country is willing to get behind this show of pageantry to celebrate their wedding. I think it's a good context to ask ourselves, how do we approach the Mass? Okay? Because we know up here that the Mass is infinitely more important than the wedding of Kate and William. It's infinitely more important. Now, we're not saying you have to dress up like the people did at Kate and William's wedding, because that's not the point of the Mass. But this morning what we're going to do is just simply look at what is the dignity of the Mass and how can we kind of get into, if you want, the dignity of the Mass. Now, I recognize that I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, right? So I'm not talking to the people that probably don't get the dignity of the Mass. But I think it's always good to have a refresher. So I'm going to start up high. And this is, let's get theological before we get down to the practical application of what does it mean to, you know, try to live our Mass well. The theology of the Mass, first of all, the Mass is liturgy. Now, you could ask yourselves, what is liturgical prayer? Because it's probably a word that some of us hear and you kind of have a vague 50% understanding. But there are different kinds of prayer in the church. The highest form, in terms of the value in and of itself, is liturgical prayer. Liturgical prayer is nothing short of the prayer of Jesus Christ himself, offering up his prayer to God the Father. Okay? So whenever you go to Mass, you are witnessing and taking part in the prayer of Christ himself. When we do Eucharistic adoration and that's followed by benediction, that is an action. It is Christ himself performing an action. It's a liturgical action. And not only is it the fact that Jesus is doing this priestly service before us, but that we, as members of his mystical body, which is the church, we are united to Christ the head in his priestly action. So when you think about, and even for example, when I pray the breviary, the other name for the breviary, there are several names, but the other common name for the breviary is the liturgy of the hours. If you pray the breviary, it is a prayer that in and of itself has more value, you could say, than, for example, the rosary or the Divine Mercy chaplet or whatever. Doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to get more out of it, because it depends very much on how you approach it. But the breviary in and of itself, because it is liturgical, you are entering into Jesus' own praying of the Psalms. When Jesus was a man walking around in the earth for years, he used to pray the Psalms. That's how he learned how to pray. And he would pray those Psalms, and, you know, as a dialogue with God, his Father. And because he became, because of his incarnation, his divinity united to his humanity, he's able to unite his earthly life to all of time and all of history, all of us. Okay? When you happen to be God, you can do those things. He took on a human nature, and through his human nature, all of us became plugged into the divinity. That happened after the resurrection. That's the result of the resurrection. That's how great the resurrection is for us. But he's allowing us to enter into his priestly function. So every time we go to Mass, we are entering into a space, a church, which is more or less pretty, depending on the particular church. Some of them are kind of atrocious. Some of them are quite beautiful, whatever. And in a sense, the beauty of the church doesn't matter. What matters is that you give God the best. If the best, you're in a third world country, the best is a cinder block church with a leaky tin roof, and I've been in them, but it is the best place that they can come up with to worship God, he is happy to be there. He's the same God that was happy to be born in the stable in Bethlehem. But if you're in a neighborhood where you're quite capable of giving him, you know, if we can build MetLife Stadium and some of these other things that we build, and then we cheap out when it comes to building his churches, well, that says something. We're not giving God the best, right? So because of what I was saying earlier, liturgy is incarnational. What does that mean? Well, it means that the liturgy is, God in a certain sense doesn't need the liturgy. It's his gift to us. You know, God, actually, he doesn't need angels and he doesn't need us. He doesn't need anything. He was perfectly, totally happy all by himself. Before he created anything else, there was just God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And he was absolutely blissfully happy. And just as happy in and of himself as if he hadn't have created anything else. The only reason he created any of us was just so that he could have someone and something to share his happiness with. It's like, why should I have happiness all to myself? Wouldn't it be great if there could be other things that are also happy? That's why he made everything, including the angels, okay? So when I say liturgy is incarnational then, it's liturgy is his sharing of himself through, because he became incarnate, he became a human being, which is body and spirit, then the liturgy is something that is, it has a material and a spiritual component. Every sacrament has a material and a spiritual component. The sacraments are visible signs. We call them visible, quote unquote. It could be an auditory sign, but, you know, for example, when the priest hears confession, he's saying something, but they are signs that come through the five senses, one way or another, that communicate grace to us. Well, the liturgy is sacramental in that sense. It is, they have a physical element to them. There's sight, there's sound, there are material elements present by which God unites the physical and the spiritual, and he brings them both up onto his altar and sanctifies them all. And this goes all the way back to creation. Adam and Eve, when God created Adam and Eve, we were different from angels. And Adam and Eve were the original priests, if you want, of all of the cosmos, the physical cosmos. God made this physical universe, which is who knows how many billions of years old by the time Adam and Eve came around. So he made all this material stuff, which in and of itself doesn't have a whole lot of meaning. until he created something that was simultaneously spiritual and physical that could elevate all of the rest of the universe. So when he made Adam and Eve, which is all of us, he made them like the priests. They're the only part of material reality that can pray to God. They can offer, they can speak on behalf of material to God, that can offer and intercede on behalf before God. And when Christ became a man, then he's basically, he's reforming that original plan, that we now have somebody who is perfectly united to God and to God's will, somebody who is absolutely immaculate and who is being simultaneously God and man, can elevate all of physical and spiritual reality before God. So again, this is what's happening every time we celebrate Mass. We're entering into a liturgy. It's not just about, is it going to be a long homily, Father? You're entering into a space where literally all of creation is being sanctified. And the guy who's going to do it is sitting there in a tabernacle somewhere waiting for you. You know, that's the reality of every Mass. Okay. More concretely, what is the Mass? And how does God do this kind of cosmic liturgy that we're talking about? Well, it is the memorial, which is a technical theological word. I've used this with you before. A memorial is not just, hey, let's all remember what Jesus did for us. Memorial is, it was a Jewish concept. Their current Passover is also a memorial in the strong sense of the word. It's a concept by which there's a liturgy that's created, and you enter into kind of, you go back in time and go back to the original place. So every time the Mass is celebrated, we don't just remember Calvary, we actually kind of go back in time and space to Calvary. It's brought to us, if you want, however you want to look at it, either way it would work. It is brought through a wormhole, so to speak, in time and space, onto our altar. And everything that happened from the Last Supper all the way through the resurrection, that entire three-day period, takes place in every Mass that's celebrated. And remember, that three-day period is what redeemed all of human, well, not just human, all of material history. The entire, it redeemed all of the cosmos, everything. And the way that Christ did this, I mean, we know that he was crucified, but fundamentally what happened was Christ, in his earthly life, was going through and kind of reliving the different major mysteries of the Old Testament. And every time some Old Testament figure messed up, Jesus, in a certain sense, went back and relived some dimension of that and did it right, and he obeyed. And the ultimate act of obedience, beginning especially in Gethsemane, was the act of obedience that kind of undid the original sin of the Garden of Eden. And this is what's taking place in every Mass. Jesus is going, and basically it is an act of obedience. Will you trust in God and be obedient to him, even if it implies giving your life? Which a lot of theologians think that would have been the original temptation that Adam and Eve had to face in the Garden of Eden. They're face-to-face with the serpent, who is, you know, it says the serpent is more subtle than anybody else, which makes you think he's this kind of cute little garter snake or something. Apparently the word used in the book of Genesis was Nahash, which was also the same word used for Leviathan. So you could think Godzilla, you know, something along those lines. That's Nahash. So he may have been a snake, but there was something. Adam and Eve, when they're confronted with this serpent, whatever scary form he did or didn't take, they realize, I'm before something that is completely beyond me, and there's really nothing I can do about it. So there was an act of cowardice involved, and Adam and Eve failed to do God's will, and basically they faced a threat that was totally beyond them. So implicit in the threat would have been the idea then, well, okay, what if this unforeseen, ominous, horrible thing does away with you? Do you still trust in God? which would imply the only way that it would work is what they would imply that there's going to be a resurrection. If they would have obeyed, and let's say God would have allowed, maybe he wouldn't have allowed them in the first place, but let's say he did allow, you know, them just to be destroyed for their act of obedience. The implication is, well, if I'm going to be faithful to my end, then I'm going to have to raise you back up. Okay? Do you trust in me under those circumstances? Well, this is what Jesus relived in his crucifixion, death, and resurrection. So he's redoing all of human history, everything that has ever gone wrong, and he's making it right. And again, this is what takes place every time you and I go to our Sunday Mass. So we can focus on the, you know, the bad music, and it usually is, and the stuffy church, and the squeaky, you know, the rosary lady with the clicking beads, and we can focus on all those things. And God, for some strange reason, seems to allow us to be submitted to all those things. Yes. Fortunately, the era of felt banners seems to be long gone. I grew up with felt banners everywhere, all the time. It's like, oh, yes. Yeah, I know. Past generations had people like Michelangelo decorating the church. How about we let loose the fifth graders? That's your thing. It's like, I mean, how that was a good idea, I don't know. So, what are the concerts? This is, I just wanted to kind of paint the theological backdrop. Why is it a big deal then that we take our Mass seriously? Well, that's why it's a big deal. If we actually understand what the heck we're walking into. And frankly, the same thing happens to me. I know you think that priests are just mystical creatures until you get to know us better. until you go to spiritual direction a few times, then you realize, nope. No, I will tell you, it is even possible during the consecration to get distracted, not just for you, but for me. It's possible. I mean, it doesn't happen that often, thanks be to God, but I mean, it's possible you can have something swirling around in your head or you can just be tired. Not too long ago, I had to really stop and think, did I consecrate the chalice did I accidentally use the words of consecration of the chalice when I was supposed to be doing the first consecration? I had to just like stop and think for a second, like, no, I did it right. Okay. But for some reason, I don't know, I was just tired and I had something going on and I was probably thinking about, I don't know what. So it can happen. So what are the consequences of everything I just said? Well, the first consequence is going to be, if the Mass is everything we just talked about, then number one, do I prioritize it? Remember, there was one of the Ten Commandments, it's in there somewhere, you know, keep holy the Sabbath. Okay. How often do I, as a priest, hear confessions, Father, I missed Mass on Sunday? Okay, well, there can be legitimate reasons, you know. Perhaps your travel, depending on what the reasons for your travel are. A lot of times when people say they missed Mass because of traveling, I say, look, now, if you're going to Kuwait or something, fine, we're going to cut you a little slack. If you're going to the Caribbean, you know, to some resort, it's like, did you figure out where you're going to eat and sleep and if you're going to have a rental car and all these things? And you're in a Catholic country and you can't figure out by Google where there's a Mass, or you can't ask the hotel if they didn't show, I mean, oh, I didn't think of that. It's like, okay. Come on. The other one that I love is, I didn't go to Mass. Well, why not? Well, my relatives came over. And usually it's in Spanish. Okay. So what? Your relatives came over. But they don't go to Mass. So? What, are you going to, you're basically, what you're, so you're going to train them, you're going to teach them, well, really, Mass isn't that big a priority to us, so if something else comes up that's more important, you know, then we'll certainly, I don't want to be rude. It's like, who cares? Give your relatives a good example. We're Catholic. We take this seriously. This is once a week. It's not like you're even every day saying, sorry, I can't be with you all night long. Once a day, or once a week for, say, an hour and a half by the time you drive and come back, a space of time, we're going to be gone. We take this seriously. You have a chance to catechize your family if they're pagans, or different religion, or whatever the particular case is. Why don't we take advantage of that? Why is this something we just, no, I couldn't. I don't know. It's what are the excuses that we offer up for simply not going to Mass? I understand as parents it's going to be rough because now with the schooling systems and sports and everything, I don't think the schools particularly respect Sundays for sports. Granted, you do live in the Northeast where you can probably, between Saturday evening, well, that's another one, was some of the, I'm much more benevolent with like the illegal immigrant kind of people who are working and say, Father, I'm working. And it's, because I'm not in their shoes and I can't really say, I mean, sometimes I realize that they're pretty powerless. But even then, I'm like, you can't possibly tell your boss, I mean, like, I will work all day Saturday and I'll work late until late at night Sunday, even though you're not supposed to work on Sunday. But anyway, I'll cut them that slack. But at least I need like a couple hours in the morning just to not be, you can't, no. Frankly, I think a lot of times we're just cowards. You know, we let human respect take over. And even if we do go to Mass, realistically, sometimes it's like, with what mentality? Okay, how can I fit in into my busy schedule, you know, whatever the most convenient way of going to Mass is? In a sense, there's nothing wrong with that. At least you're going to Mass and you're trying. But if our mentality is try to get everything else done and then hopefully I can squeeze in a Mass, which even if it's at 7:30 at night at the end, and sometimes that's the best you can do. But if that's our mentality, are we really giving it the best place? Because if we're not giving it kind of pride of place, then very easily, then the next logical step is, well, I feel so bad, I couldn't go this weekend, too bad. Well, next weekend, Jesus understands. Yeah, he understands that you prioritized everything else, and then you hoped you could try to sneak it in, and it didn't work. Now, again, there are scenarios where, sometimes with all the best intention in the world, you're driving back from Washington, D.C., you have every intention to go to the 5 o'clock Sunday Mass, you get a flat tire, okay, fine. That's not your fault. You made a reasonable plan. Some unforeseen circumstance came up that you couldn't do anything about. God gets that. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you're kind of like rolling the dice, well, if everything works out perfectly, we might make it to Mass 10 minutes late. Forget it. And then something happened, so we couldn't. What are we prioritizing it? You know, basically, we're giving God the leftovers. And if there's nothing left over, well, sorry, God. Okay, number two, approaching Mass, prayerfulness. What does this mean? It sounds very obvious, but I would say this. The way that we approach Mass is going to be directly correlated to the way that we pray outside of Mass. So if you are women who pray every day, especially if you're RC members and you have your prayer commitments several times a day and you're taking them seriously and you're working well, and then you're going to take Mass seriously. It's a guarantee. And you will probably take it more seriously than basically anything else. Because you've already developed a relationship with God. He is a person, or three persons if you prefer. So you have your priorities set. Are you angels? No, fine. That's why we need to go to Mass, because we're not angels. But fundamentally, to the extent that we are men and women who pray, we will value our Mass. That's why saints and mystics, you know, they death before missing Mass, you know, and they the extents that they will go to and the benefit that they derive from Mass, because the more prayerful you are, the more that you are nourished in prayer, the more you realize just what you're getting in Mass, and the more you will realize this is the only thing really that matters. Not the Mass in and of itself, but the relationship with God, the love of God, and the recognition of his gift to us and acknowledging it and thanking him. This is the only thing that really matters. Everything else is just fluff. So, one way that I would say we can, and I'm sure a lot of you do this, but one pro tip to live our Mass well, even if we are men and women who pray regularly, try to arrive at least a few minutes early, okay, and stay a few minutes late. If you can get there, you know, 5 minutes early and just spend a little bit of time in prayer before Mass and kind of get yourself in the zone, that's very helpful. And the same thing after Mass, a little time of thanksgiving. Because there's enough distraction even in the church. All you need are, I personally, by the way, I'm not against crying babies because to me, that's life. Now, sometimes some of these moms, I'm like, okay, you know what, your kid is just being annoying. Just take him out until he calms down. But for example, that out there, I love hearing that. That's when you hear kids just, okay, mom, lady, just have a little common sense and get him out until he calms down. But
Dad can take him out too, right here.
sorry, what?
Dad can take him out too.
Not just mom.
Oh, dad can take him out too, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's presuming dad's even in the church. Yeah, somebody take him out if he's going crazy. But personally, I like hearing baby noises, just like the little squeaks and stuff that they do. But it's a very good practice to stay a little late and arrive a little early and just kind of thank God for what you received and be cognizant and kind of spend the time to get ready. Okay, number three, also very practical. I remember Father Benedict Groeschel saying the following. He said, talking about, you want to know something to live your Mass well? Get dressed for Sunday. And he said this, he said, if you go to a wealthy parish, sometimes it looks like people are on the way to their beach when you're in the church. If you go to a really wealthy parish, it looks like they're getting back from the beach. But he said, that's his words, not mine. But he said, actually, if you go to the poor parishes, the people will dress to the nines a lot of the times. I haven't been to some of those parishes, but again, it's not a fashion show. We don't want to necessarily look again like the marriage of Kate and William. But I would say modesty. Modesty, dignity, elegance. You're going to something special. There are two different poles that we want to address. On the one hand, you are in the presence of Almighty God and you want to give him the very best. On the other hand, he is also a God who is familiar to you, like a family member in a sense. He chooses to make himself that familiar. So there's this kind of strange combination of intimacy and respect and awe that simultaneously needs to be present in all our relationships with God. Another is very simple, silence in the church. Okay. Sometimes, actually, I've become a little bit of a hypocrite myself now, but I grew up, you don't talk in church. You just don't. Yeah, I mean, certainly you don't converse. Obviously, if you have to say something, you're not going to pull out sign language and have people rubbing braille strips. But unnecessary talking in church. Again, one, because you're in God's house, but I think it creates an atmosphere where if we're just out talking, hey, Jim, how are you doing? Okay, what's happening is this is becoming a common hall. It is not a special place reserved to God. You can be friendly, you can greet people and do this and whatnot, but kind of common conversation. You can always go out to the outside or in the reception area or whatever. There's always time and place to do that. I mean, you can obviously do a little greeting for 30 seconds or less. Hey, good to see you. It's been a while and everything. I don't think God's going to be offended by that. But if you're going to start getting prolonged and bring people together, calling across the church, again, we've turned that which is sacred into something common. By the way, you know where the word sacred comes from? The original biblical concept of holiness. This is actually important for maintaining the idea of respect. The original biblical idea of holiness, or that which is sacred, means that which is separated, not for common use. So, for example, if I have a chalice and the chalice has been consecrated, it's a gold cup. I could have two gold chalices. One is consecrated and the other is not. You could drink wine or Coca-Cola or whatever you want out of the one golden chalice, and it wouldn't really matter. But the one that's been consecrated is sacred. It is set aside for sacred purposes, only for the Mass. So the church building and those things that take place within it, that is sacred space. It is reserved for the things of God. It is reserved for an encounter with God, which is why we don't just socialize in there and chit-chat and chew gum and, you know, do all the things that we tend to see with a certain frequency in a lot of churches. It's sacred space for sacred actions and for sacred encounters. So related to that, I have 3 points here. Silence, posture, and genuflections are kind of self-explanatory, right? You know, sit up straight, kneel if your knees are good enough. You know, genuflect, again, if your knees are good enough. Most of us, if not, then you can bow. But I mean, there's a reverent way of doing things. The church is not going to be hung up on if you do the two-knee genuflection or whatever. The important thing is, whatever you're doing it, do it with reverence. There's always a reverent way of doing things. It's like when you're an altar server. You know, I tell the altar servers, look, you can mess up. You can be in the wrong place at the wrong time. It doesn't really matter as long as you do it reverently. So if you start walking and you realize I'm not supposed to, just with dignity, bow, go back. Nobody's even going to notice. If you start doing all these weird things, then everyone's going to notice, right? So just solemnly and dignified, do the wrong thing, and then in a solemn and dignified way, go back and go where you're supposed to do, and it won't disrupt anything. I think the same principle applies to us. So if you go to a place where everybody is acting that way, you're going to realize there's something important here, and you're not going to be so inclined to be goofing off and doing other things, right? If you go there and everyone's acting like it's a dance hall, well, then you're going to be more inclined to start acting like it's a dance hall yourself. Receiving communion. The church allows, okay, there are liturgy wars on the tongue, in the hand, whatever. Father Eric is of the opinion, I don't care. Okay. Again, the principle that I follow is, I don't care as long as you are reverent. I've seen teenage kids come up, you know, kids, I used to do it too, but there's something about kids that we like to write on our hands. It's like, this is like a post-it. So I've seen kids with like dirty hands off the playground with notes and stuff, and I'm like, you know what, no. You are receiving it, but I'm not going to suck. It's like if you're sending Jesus to one of those neighborhoods in Brooklyn with all the graffiti, and you know, it's like, okay, get out there. Like, no. But you know, if a person has clean hands, knows what they're doing, reverently receiving. By the way, there's a way to receive communion. This came from Pope Benedict, so this is not just Father Eric's little hang up, okay? Even amongst pious people, there are some of the Eucharistic grabbers. The three-finger pinch. So the priest does the body of Christ, and then you get pious, reverent people, but sometimes they get no. Pope Benedict himself said, one hand on top of the other, you receive, you don't take. Only the priest, is it because he's in persona Christi, only the priest takes for himself. Even the deacon receives from the priest. And again, this is with the best of intentions, so it's not like I think anyone's being irreverent or anything, but there's a difference between taking and receiving. So, is it easier to go about receiving communion reverently on the tongue? I would say probably yes. But interestingly enough, the original idea when Vatican II changed the norm and said we're going to receive in the hand, Father Bannon, who was our national director for many years, he's the one that got the Legion and Regnum Christi really going here in the U.S. Some of you know him, some of you old schoolers. He's a priest that, he's now in heaven, but he's one of the legionaries that I've most admired in my whole life. He was talking to the Bishop of Hartford, who was in the Vatican Council at the time, that particular bishop. I think he was Whalen at the time. And he was in the section on the liturgy, and he asked him, because the legionaries, we were quasi-Latino, so we would always receive in the tongue kneeling. He asked the bishop, why did we make the change to receiving in the hand? It lends itself to abuses. And he said, well, it probably didn't work too well, but the original idea was to increase reverence. The sense of, if you are holding God and you are recognizing, I have God in my hand, and then there's an increased kind of a protagonism, I guess would be the word, I don't know. The sometimes we have unintended consequences. You're thinking up one thing and then the exact opposite happens, which I think sadly frequently happens. But you can. I know many people who do receive the Eucharist reverently in their hand, and I'm totally fine with that. I'm never going to be one of those that says no. Even during COVID, well, actually, COVID was the opposite. Even during COVID, when the people would want to receive on the tongue, I would always say, yes, no, nope. I'm not going to stop you. Yeah, just don't lick me. Occasionally. I remember in the Philippines, there was one lady I used to crack up. She was one of these pious old ladies, and she had these huge lips full of lipstick. So, and she would just, like, do this little mouth. You're trying to navigate into there, okay? You'd always come out just painted, just like, oh. It's like, get an extra purificator. Here she comes. I felt kind of like in Star Wars where Luke is going to blow up the Death Star. He's got to aim it down that little thing. So, but she was very pious, and you could tell she was totally, you know, she'd have her eyes closed. And okay. Liturgical form. What do I mean by this? There are different kinds of liturgies. We know that. Some churches are going to be more traditional, you would say. Some churches are going to be all the way extraordinary form. In the Latin Mass, the Missal of, I guess, John the 23rd, because he updated the Missal. Is it John the 23rd? I think updated the Missal. But essentially the Tridentine Mass that we normally think of when we say the words Latin Mass. Some people would be Novus Ordo, ordinary American Sunday parish. You'll have some more kind of charismatic liturgies, or, you know, the Hispanics will be kind of charismatic in a different way, but it's kind of livelier, more folksy, I would say. Again, this is just me talking, so this is no longer John Paul II's document. These liturgies, there are different approaches to encountering God. And I think the important thing is not going to be so much the form or the external elements as it will be what is the disposition behind them and the way that we go about doing them. Okay. I personally tend to like more solemn, and I'm liturgically lazy, or in the sense that I like very solemn but very stark. I think that's a legionary trait, by the way. We tend to be very streamlined in our liturgy. So we can, the Vatican used to always get us to be the altar servers for Christmas and Easter and stuff because we know what we're doing. But you're not generally going to go to legionary masses and have everything is sung a Gregorian. There'll be some Gregorian, you know, and all the different bells and whistles and all the beretta and the different sorts of vestments and all that. We will tend to be fairly streamlined. But you will also notice that we tend to be quite reverent. People frequently comment to me, it's just like, actually, one time I was spaced out. I didn't even know what she was trying to tell me. I said, Father, thank you for the consecration. And I'm like, did I do a consecration after Mass? I thought it was like after Mass, some sort of consecration of the church or people. I said, I don't remember doing it. No, it was just me celebrating Mass. There was nothing, it was just the way I celebrate Mass. Thank you, Father. Because we try to be reverent. Okay. In recent years, God has kind of stuck me in more, you call them, well, both kind of your folksy Latino circles and your kind of charismatic circles, and I've gradually grown to appreciate those. For example, when you go to St. Peter's in Yonkers, you'll see later, and they've actually got like drums in the front of the church, and they've got choir and music and everything. But if you want to see church participation, go to St. Peter's Easter Vigil liturgy. That place was rocking. But, you see people happy, taking part. I I have never gone to like some Tridentine Mass and seen people that engaged in the liturgy like I see at St. Peter's. Now, personally, it's not always my cup of tea, and we make jokes about it and kind of a three-ring circus and all that, but it is engaging the people in their faith deeply. So I would say, rather than let's worry about the liturgical form, let's worry about is there reverence? Is there awe on the one hand? Is there personal encounter? And from the liturgy, is there transformation and conversion? So if the people, by and large, are being transformed and converted and holier from their participation in the liturgy, then the liturgy is doing what it's supposed to do. Those masses and settings and churches and whatnot that are more, you would say, solemn, what they communicate is that something supernatural is taking place. This is not banal. When you go into a church, it looks like not necessarily St. Peter's, but one of these, you know, either Gothic, beautiful churches. You got a lot of Neo-Gothic in the Northeast because that was kind of the popular thing when these beautiful churches were being built, or some of these Italian Baroque churches. And just the artwork and everything speaks to the fact that there's something important that takes place. And when you go in there and there's the incense and there's beautiful music and there's decorum and the nice vestments and all that, it makes you understand through the five senses, there's, like I said, there's something important. It is supernatural. It demands reverence. It demands dignity. So that is the purpose of all those elements. Now, there's a danger also, and the danger is that you can fall into ritualism. What do I mean by that? Sometimes we focus more on the particulars of the ritual and the beauty of the ritual, and we can convince ourselves we're getting sanctified through that. And what sometimes you can see is people taking part in those liturgies regularly can become righteous in the sense that you don't see them committing big sins. They're not going out, you know, committing big sexual sins and drinking and cheating and sin. They're good people. They're not doing a lot of bad stuff. But they can fall into a fortress mentality. The world is a bad place, and here is where there is righteousness within these walls, and by praying in this way with these people, we will be holy. You know, Father, you've heard me mention Father Chad Ripperger, right? He's one of the exorcists I frequently will cite. He's a traditionalist priest. He's a very funny guy, and he's very balanced. He says, even though I celebrate the traditional liturgy, I tend to like hanging out with Novus Ordo people more. And he says, and he's talking about, and he's serious, he says, because the judgmentalism that can characterize some of the more traditional circles, mm-hmm. he said, he's talking about generational spirits, which is a whole other concept we can go into. He says the generational spirit that we fall into in traditional circles is we can become judgmental mm-hmm. and critical and criticizing, and everything is always finding something to complain about or criticize, and it could have been better or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you lose the sense of why the heck are we here in the first place? We are here to grow in faith, hope, and love, and in a personal encounter with Christ. Okay, that is the purpose of liturgy. And you can ask yourself, for example, when you see some of these parishes that are more traditional, you would say, and again, I tend a little bit in that direction by preference myself, but you can look around and you say, do you see missions? Do you see people evangelizing or inviting their friends? Do you see, reaching out to society? Not so often. A lot of times it's about closing in. And if you want to come join us, that's fine. That's a danger. I'm not saying that it's a bad form of belief. I'm just saying that is the danger to which that form of spirituality is susceptible. The other extreme would be kind of your charismatic, folksy, community-oriented masses, where the music can be really lively. You know, the sentiments can be high. Can you lose a sense of the reverence and an understanding of what's taking place? Yeah, you can. Can people become overly dependent on sentiment in your kind of more either folksy or community-oriented or charismatic kind of liturgies and spiritualities? Yes. Is there the danger that you can depend on all of your prayers are always in community, but you don't have a personal prayer life? I've seen that. Again, when I was doing youth ministry in Yonkers, and there were some beautiful kids there, and, you know, I love a lot of the people. I've had some good friends and whatnot, but I do remember one of the characteristics was, I'm trying to teach kids, you know what, we need a little bit of silence in our lives, and you need some daily personal prayer commitments. It's not the same for you to pray with your girlfriend, or for you to go, the only time you ever pray is when you're inside a church because St. Peter's organizes something. You need, those activities are good and you need those, but you also need just to spend time yourself, one-on-one with God. You need your morning meditation, whatever that form that takes, and you need to pray the rosary alone sometimes. You know, you need to, it's not everything is in common. Because what happens is you need to be able to learn how to pray when your emotions are not the driving force. Sometimes you're not going to feel like praying. Does that mean you don't pray? I don't feel like going. Father, I can't pray. My emotions are like, so what? What, you, I mean, when you get married and have kids, well, I don't feel like changing the diapers right now, so. It's like, no, it's not even an option. When you love, you're taking on duties. When you love, it goes beyond what you feel like in a given moment, right? Frequently, that is the test of love, is precisely because it's difficult and things that you don't feel like doing in a given moment, and nonetheless, because you love the person, then it changes things. Is there in those atmospheres sometimes a greater dichotomy between worship, you know, when you're in the church and everything is love God, you can take my life right now and everything. And then once you leave the church, they're going out getting drunk and, you know, and again, I remember, you know, 3-day retreats, you know, weekend retreats with my kids and, you know, slain in the spirit on the floor, knocked out, and legitimately, and praying and testimonies and all. And then you find out that very night, they're posting pictures of doing tequila shots, smoking their hookah, and probably having sex. And not posting pictures of that, but I mean, you're like, that was 4 hours ago. You are coming back from this weekend. And this is like, so is there a greater danger? Because it's dependent on emotion sometimes, or can be. Is there a greater danger there? Yeah. So both of these, you know, I think we need both elements in our liturgy. The liturgy should be, I would say, solemn, but participative. It should be dignified. There's a whole gamut of possible approaches, you know, depending. And God allows different spiritualities to reach different kinds of people, right? Different cultures, different individuals will resonate with different kinds of spirituality. I remember in our house in Rye, back when Father Stephen Rye was there, I remember he mentioned once, he said, you know, had it not been for the Second Vatican Council, we probably would have lost all of Latin America to the Protestant sects. Mm-hmm. Had we stuck with the Tridentine Mass, because you think of the Latinos, with the Protestants coming in, playing guitars, having lively liturgies and everything, most of the Latinos would have gone there. We probably would have lost most of Latin America to them. had we not made the liturgical changes that we made in Vatican II. Interesting reflection. It never occurred to me before. You think about that. That's the majority of our church, by the way, is Latino. We don't tend to think about that in the U.S., but the majority of Catholics in the world right now are Latino. Maybe some Africans are catching up, but that's the backbone of Catholicism globally. Imagine if we would have lost that. So there's beautiful legitimacy there, but anyway, I don't know where I'm going with all that. So the point is, in the end of the day, liturgy is, just as a recap, it is nothing less than entering into the very prayer of Christ, who, as members of his mystical body, he allows us to pray in union with him who is the head. Therefore, the way we act, dress, speak, the artwork in the church, the way the liturgy is celebrated, all those things need to reflect the fact that it is Christ's work that is taking place. As priests, we need to remember, I don't own the liturgy. That's actually one of the things. One of my classmates said that when we were right before ordination, but we were talking about, said, look, I don't own the liturgy, so I just have to follow what's in the book. And it's true. The book gives you a lot of leeway. It gives you all, frequently you've got all kinds of legitimate options you can take, but you got to follow what's in the book. It's not my liturgy. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to Christ. And the church is the interpreter of how Christ is going to, how he wants to bring it about. And as participants, again, we are called simultaneously to kind of approach the liturgy with reverential awe, but simultaneously with that personal encounter, joy. There should be joy in liturgy. The joy that comes from personally encountering Christ and allowing the liturgy to transform us, to convert us, so that we in turn will then go out and do things like the Holy Week missions and bring our friends on board and find ways in the practical day-to-day living to bring Christ to society. So.